The Food and Drug Administration approves the first non-stimulant medication for adults with ADHD in decades. We spend the hour on adult attention deficit hyperactivity disorder on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. It is the most common neuropsychiatric disorder in children, but also one of the most common in adults. That's according to the National Resource Center on ADHD that says 17 million Americans are affected. Are you? Join in on adult ADHD diagnosis, treatment, how it affects your life, 800-642-1234. Dr. Jake Behrens is a psychiatrist, evaluates and treats adult ADHD patients, CEO and medical director of Envision ADHD Clinic in Milwaukee. Dr. Behrens, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, there are studies being published showing such a surge of the number of adults with ADHD, jumping 123% from 2007 to 2016. What is going on?
Well, it's more complicated if you look at the incidence of things. That's going to be related to, is it being looked for? Are people searching kind of help for it? Doesn't mean it didn't exist. It just means there are people aware of it or looking for it or actually having access to trying to get care. Right now, obviously, there's been a lot more, I'll call it awareness pushes, be it on social media. Certain companies out there are trying to, not going to say push the diagnosis, but bring awareness to it. As other people are moving forward in the pandemic, are they adjusting to things at home? Are they realizing, like, oh my gosh, I have been struggling. Is this something going on? Because really the diagnosis went from zero and never existed past age 18 for, until relatively recently, to now it's something that's actually being looked at.
You created a clinic to address ADHD in adults. Who are you, the type of patients who seek you out?
All types. I work with adults. It came out of working in a general practice and realizing the unique needs of often kind of higher functioning adults with ADHD who are having to lose so much time, taking time away from work to maintain treatment, get evaluated. And that's where Envision came from, is how can we kind of fit this into the lives of busy professionals well. Although getting into the space, you know, it's been about 6 years now, it's been very different in that there's such a need and people are not able to get into their healthcare system or to find care in different ways. So I've seen a far more diverse kind of population than I was expecting when I first kind of started this different model and really didn't know how it would do.
What have you noticed from the patient profiles?
That it's been so difficult for people to be able to get into care, you know, with wait lists. You know, it's to see a psychiatrist is often months in general practice. To take it a step further, if they require more specifically for ADHD, which a lot of psychiatrists, primary care may be less comfortable working with, it could be, you know, more in like the 6 to 9 months. So I find people with all different types of access to healthcare, all different kind of backgrounds have found it, basically by, I don't do any marketing, but going through Google searches, and that's really been a surprise to me. Of what it was getting into the space. I knew there was a need. I didn't know how big it was.
We're talking about ADHD with Dr. Jake Behrens, who is a Milwaukee psychiatrist looking at the evaluation and treatment of adult ADHD this hour. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your stories, your questions. Let's bring on Laura in Milwaukee. Laura, hi.
Hi. I'm 40 years old now, but I was not diagnosed with ADHD until I was 27. And prior to that, I was able to skate by. You know, I got decent grades throughout high school, but it was a challenge for me to stay on task. So I took somewhat easy courses, and I would switch jobs frequently because I would get bored or overwhelmed. When I was finally diagnosed, I went in thinking I had just an anxiety issue, but my psychiatrist was able to read between the lines, and he asked me a series of questions, you know, how many jobs have you had, what was school like, et cetera. And so I was medicated with Adderall, and so So it's been 13 years, and my life has completely changed for the better. I was suddenly able to concentrate when I was having a phone call. I've held down the same job for years. I was able to be patient with my son. So it's been a life changer.
Laura, thank you for your willingness to share your story. Dr. Behrens, are these the types of symptoms and situations that patients like Laura are in?
Oh, completely. And this is where I think we have such an idea of ADHD, and even the way it's taught, quite frankly, the way it's still taught in medical school and psychiatry residencies, is that image of that hyperactive young boy bouncing off the walls, driving people nuts, like, please get us help. But what we realize in here is ADHD is not just lack of attention and the hyperactivity. It's what's going on with their executive function, the ability for us to slow down, to organize, prioritize everything coming out of that Ferrari engine in our head that's going on, so that we can slow it down when we need to, so we can navigate the curves, the traffic, the road construction on these highways that we have. It doesn't mean failure. It doesn't mean bouncing off, driving people nuts. But, you know, of what you saw there starting, you know, it didn't just pop up out of the blue, but it was going back through life. You know, it wasn't failing miserably in every course, but you saw the kind of the pattern that was in there. It's not uncommon at all that if you go talk to someone about something, it's likely to come up, you're likely to get diagnosed with depression or anxiety. And what I see with ADHD is if we really kind of break it down and get to the finer points, we look, is it so much that we're anxious and that's getting only when we're anxious that we struggle with concentration, or is the concentration there kind of, that's the baseline. Yeah, and when we start falling behind, like when you know what you're capable of doing, but you're not getting there, mm-hmm. you get more overwhelmed, you get more frustrated in those moments. And then over time, you kind of lose faith in yourself, you kind of lose that self-confidence, and just kind of leads more towards what I'll call it kind of burnout. So you have to keep changing jobs. You need that novelty, you need that stimulation, you need, in some ways, you start learning to live in a sense of, in a state of stress, because that's actually where you function best. That's where you're getting that stimulation. So what I've the story there of diagnosed, you know, at 27 and going forward and then seeing those changes. I'm hoping as you've gone through, you've actually seen that kind of even that what it was kind of anxiety has actually gotten better with treatment as you've been in better control of your life, not just work, but home, work, school, relationships. It's all of life.
Laura referenced Adderall, a stimulant, Ritalin, another stimulant that is prescribed. Why are stimulants prescribed for a mental health disorder that also involves hyperactivity?
Yeah, and that's, you know, the term ADHD, I think, is a misnomer. It doesn't mean you can never pay attention. It doesn't just mean it's hyperactivity bouncing off the walls. And the same with stimulants. We have the idea that a stimulant is just something that just jacks everybody up. It doesn't make any intuitive sense. You know, here's a hyperactive child that's given a bunch of caffeine or a bunch of sugar in the short term, which are kind of more general stimulants that kind of turn everything up. If you look at, you know, quote unquote, a stimulant medication, you got to ask, well, what is it stimulating? What is it doing? It, you know, if it's, quote unquote, in here, stimulating or kind of activating the parts of the brain involved with kind of executive function, the organizing, prioritizing, inhibiting of the rest of the brain that it kind of regulates, or basically, are we stimulating the brakes? And that would have a very different picture. And technically, stimulant medications, we've actually have evidence of them predating, this is going back to 1937, before ADHD was ever a term in psychiatry, before there was even any psychiatric medications, which technically didn't come out until the 50s. There was this phenomenon that when this type of medication is used to try and treat headaches in behaviorally challenged boys, but there was this inverse kind of slowing down or kind of kids being able to regulate and manage themselves differently. That's where that came from. And it's still been that, I think, poorly understood, even within the medical community, of kind of what it is that they're working. And we think we have to change from the word stimulant more towards, or at least ask the question, okay, what is this stimulating? Because then it starts to make a lot more sense.
Psychiatrist Jake Behrens with us, helping us get a firmer understanding of ADHD, which can be mild, moderate, severe. Join in on adult diagnosis, on symptoms, treatment, your story, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Behrens here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about adult ADHD as a new medication emerges. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The advocacy group CHAD and its research center on ADHD says without proper diagnosis and treatment, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder can lead to bad consequences like school and job failure, depression, relationship problems, reduced life expectancy. Psychiatrist Jake Behrens has a clinic in Milwaukee, focuses on this mental health disorder, is with us for the hour. Dr. Behrens, I'm wondering about if you can break down some of the symptoms that people have and what you look for as you go through an initial evaluation.
Sure. Well, I'd say, you know, the evaluation itself, when I'm looking at it, is it's often a lot of data coming in at one point, which makes it often difficult to do in just kind of one session or just one time. If you walk into someone and say, I can't focus or I want to learn about ADHD, because it's going to be a lot of history of really going back over time of, you know, have things like, what have things been like in childhood? How would parents and teachers have described you? What has that been like through school? How's it been at work? How's it been in relationships at home? And a lot of trying to look at there is, what is it like, you know, in terms of getting started with projects, finalizing things, what's it like in conversations, in lectures, often, you know, at work, kind of doing different tasks. What's it like sitting down to do a test versus, you know, writing a paper or something that takes a long period of time? Is it a lot of procrastination? Do things all have to be done last minute? Do you need to be under some sort of pressure, deadline, stress to actually get yourself kind of functional, so to speak? Is it something that other people around you, you know, family, friends, coworkers, you know, I always say with ADHD, it's not like, oh my gosh, here's this horrible struggling person that's having such a, not horrible person, but someone with a kind of horrible thing that's really struggling. I often look at a lot of the stories I look for, the things that would, you know, kind of like the punchline stories that come up at like the Thanksgiving table amongst family members, that, you know, little nicknames or things that people are known for. And when I'm looking, do we see a consistent pattern in history going back through, you know, into childhood versus just something that just popped up out of the blue? And is it consistent across multiple settings? Not just, well, my wife says I don't listen, or, you know, I don't like math, so I don't pay attention in that class. But is it something consistent in all different parts of life? And for me, it's a lot of, you know, really detailed history, full psychiatric medical history, really getting into those, the nitty gritty, combined with more standardized kind of rating scales. Mm-hmm. I always want to make sure we're looking at depression, anxiety, ADHD, ruling out other conditions, making sure we get into more of a sleep history as well. Sleep concerns or apnea can really take an effect as well. And then I'm generally, there's people talk about testing. Technically, quote unquote, like testing is not required kind of part of diagnosis. It's kind of a controversial area of what is required. But I do like to bring in some form of neurocognitive testing just to show on how we perform on more objective measures. Do we show difference than your age match peers in some areas, more of planning, memory, focused attention, inhibition? And I just look, do we see internal consistency amongst history, standardized rating scales, cognitive testing, and then generally some form of collateral, meaning somebody that knows you well that can kind of confirm, yes, this is something that I see. These are some of my observations. So
a patient's relative or partners or people close to them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that's so important.
Let's take another call now. April is with us from Germantown. April, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hello. Yeah, thank you so much for the discussion. This is wonderful. I've had issues with ADHD since childhood, but I was never diagnosed. And I would have like shaky legs in school from like really young, and then racing mind, and, you know, I had trouble in school unless I could focus, and then I would ace things. So, and I've been successful in my career. I'm now in my 50s, and I've been diagnosed with anxiety disorder most of my life. And I've known, and everyone around me knows, I have ADHD, and it's something that I just have to, you know, constantly refocus and constantly like have to, my mind races. So I have to try to slow down and try to look at things from other people's perspective. And it's just like a constant realignment of my mind. And I've just kind of adapted. So when I talked to my psychiatrist, I said, you know, I know I have ADHD. Everyone around me knows I have ADHD. My son has it. Can I get treated for it? And he told me that it's very complicated. If I'm an adult, I'd have to go through a lot of testing. It's hard to get insurance to cover it. And we kind of left it at that. So I know that I'm not at my best. And it's, you know, it is limiting in certain areas with, you know, being present in the moment sometimes with my children, or, you know, I see it in certain areas, and I, again, try meditation and other skills. But I think this is really interesting. So do you find that, that sometimes it's hard to get diagnosed as an adult?
April, thank you.
For sure. You know, it's still, I would say, if going through training, years out of training now, but in even from medical school to residency within psychiatry and our training going forward, is I find there is a lot of, I would say, stigma on the adult, particularly the adult ADHD side, where we have less training, there's less understanding of it. And I think, I don't know if I'll call it an ego type of thing, that if we're working with someone in psychiatry, we're used to people, you know, we'll say very sick. We really need the help kind of get from the, you know, to kind of get back to normal, so to speak, is how medicine works. If we work with people that have some level of functioning, let alone, you know, decent level of, you know, of functioning, like what is the issue? Why do they need help? And I think, in, you know, we're aware of all the struggles. Just because you're not failing doesn't mean we're not struggling. And I think getting others to understand where that's coming from is difficult. We also have this idea that, well, if you can't focus, you know, it sounds like a willpower thing. Just pay attention and sit still. If we don't really understand what's going on with executive function, or how that's not just studying or just work, but it's all aspects of life. It's from driving, it's from being in a conversation, it's making plans with friends, it's winding down at night and getting to sleep. Like, all of these things are affected. But what I see, you know, anytime we're going to work with a given institution, a given physician, a given insurance network, they're all going to have their different ways of going about it. I find anytime I would see in, you know, to me, it was an easy niche to get into. I enjoyed working with patients with ADHD. Going back in the residency, it was people I identified with. They liked using the high-tech tools to collect rating scales and outcome tracking. So I liked working with them. I saw things improve a lot. But I saw with many others, in moments someone says they can't focus, it was a big eye roll. And the part I can understand is it's a lot of data to gather. And if someone walks into what I call like a cold eval, like doctor asks, so what brings you in today? And you say, well, I want to talk about ADHD or I can't focus. It turns into this. There's so much more that, oh my gosh, I don't know where to go with this. It's going to take so long. And it tries to kind of be outsourced. The testing aspect, you know, it's going to come down to your insurance network and what they require. Different places are going to have different requirements. Technically, from a diagnosis standpoint, it's a clinical diagnosis. It comes down to history. Sometimes they'll want neuropsychiatric testing. Sometimes it's required for certain accommodations. But yes, that's going to be a long time to get into, probably 6 to 8 hours of your time and thousands of dollars, not likely covered by insurance. Is it required for a formal diagnosis? No. From any of the standards, any of the guidelines, you can say there it is not. Sometimes it can be used to augment if it's complicated. But I'm with you, depending on if we think of health insurance equaling health care, you're going to be limited to whatever their rules and things are. And that'll be different for each system. Or if we think of, okay, health care is regardless of insurance, we have different options. But it's kind of recently, it's been a bit of a wild, wild west, is with some changes during the pandemic with their ability to prescribe certain types of medications. There's been a huge growth of some of these venture capital funded growth startups that are all about basically patient client acquisition and growth more so than patient care, which is kind of frightening. So we're kind of in a unique place. And I hope we don't kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater with some of the changes in regulations, where it was so difficult to get care. And now it's almost one side of being too easy to get care. And I hope the pendulum doesn't swing too much in the other direction.
I really want to dig into medications and, you know, the addictive qualities, and also just, you know, is the risk of overprescribing out there. And we're going to get to that with Dr. Jake Behrens. Treats Adults with ADHD practice located in Milwaukee, fielding questions, myth busting about the mental health disorder that affects millions of Americans from all walks of life. Join in on ADHD, your experience, your questions, 800-642-1234. We're going to pick this up with Dr. Behrens right after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing adult ADHD this hour, what proper diagnosis and treatment entails, hearing your stories as well. As the National Center on ADHD says, it's a common mental health disorder affecting more than 4% of adults in our country. That would mean over 10 million Americans. Dr. Jake Behrens, psychiatrist, stays with us. Let's go to Betty now in Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Betty, hi. What is your experience you'd like to share?
Well, I guess what I wanted to share was that I had ADHD from the time I was a child. I was very hyperactive. I couldn't concentrate at school. I mean, either I got something or I didn't. And I know that when I went to my doctor trying to get diagnosed as an adult, you know, finally I just got upset and I just said, well, what's the worst thing's going to happen if you put me on the ADHD medicine? And I was told, well, you feel like you're on speed. And I'm like, well, I already feel that way. So they put me on it. And, you know, the first month or so, I slept a lot. I mean, I had this sense of inner peace that I never had before. But then, you know, because I, like I said, you know, either I get things or I don't. I like to rock hunt. I like to, do genealogy stuff. And I'm good at it. You know, it's like a puzzle and I love doing it. But because I can do that, I'll have people that question whether or not I actually have it.
So, Betty, how do you feel today?
Today I feel good. I've got a very couple of good supportive doctors that help me. But, you know, it's still just the stigma. And the other thing, too, is my great niece was just diagnosed with it. And when she found out I had it, too, you know, you could see this relief in her face. You know, like, oh, she's going to get me. You know, because you really don't ever really feel normal.
Betty, thank you. Let's see what Dr. Jake Behrens has to say.
Yeah. Well, I think in here is sometimes we have this idea that, and we work with a doctor and like, I'm going to get diagnosed and now I have this terrible condition, I have this terrible thing we have to go through. But that's always the case with it. I always thought with ADHD, to me, it was a gift. You know, you have the horsepower, you have this Ferrari engine going on in there. And it's not about trying to take away the horsepower, or we don't go to war with it. We don't fight it. Like we use those terms of so many things in medicine. We want to eradicate cancer, depression, anxiety. We want to take it away. ADHD, I think, if it's more of a gift we want to hone, we'd rather kind of fine tune the brakes, as you say, to have you in control in the moment. You can still do the things that, you know, that you have your kind of gift with, but in all the other things, can we get it so the brakes work when you need them to? So you can have that peace and sit down and kind of keep yourself, you know, kind of, I always say it's the thing seems so simple, but for someone that doesn't understand what's going on in the ADHD brain and how just sitting down to watch TV or on vacation, sitting on a beach, the things that should be so easy and so relaxing, that's actually where a lot of the struggle is. And what it means to actually just kind of bring that down so you can break when you need to can be life-changing.
Are medications for ADHD prone at all to addiction? Are they addictive for adults?
I'll break it down into kind of two categories from the medication side of what they call stimulants, and I'll just refer to it as non-stimulants. The stimulant class, where there is that what they call the the kind of highest evidence base for likelihood of benefit, the highest effect sizes across the medications. But they are controlled substances. They're Schedule II in the same class, technically, as kind of as opiate medications for pain. They work very differently, but there is abuse potential. You know, in the past, there were a lot of, you know, misuse of the terms abuse versus misuse. One is abuse is using something despite a negative consequence, and you keep using it. You can't stop using it. Misuse is you're using it other than as prescribed. And with this stimulant, so there are concerns. If people are using it to get a rev, a kick, a jolt, a high out of it, or if they're one of the common side effects can be wake promotion, so being more awake while it's active in your system. And if people are using it to not sleep, to go out, to stay up, and you're going to come spiraling down with that. Another thing with it is if, you know, lower appetite, eating disorders are real things. If people are using it to lose weight, to not eat, to lose weight to the detriment of their body, there are a lot of major concerns with it. You know, depending on how dosed or kind of for the individual, you know, potential changes in mood and irritability. Once again, it's not something that should be put in the drinking water by any means.
Is the science settled on whether ADHD can be outgrown?
If it can be outgrown, well, certainly the science can't say that. What we're seeing is actually the likelihood of going on to into adulthood. Generally, well, more recent studies now is roughly kind of like 2/3 will continue to go on into adulthood. Mm-hmm. Once again, it's going to be a lot of selection bias. How is it being looked at? You know, just because it's not quote unquote diagnosed doesn't mean there's not still underlying issues. It's always going to be on a spectrum of how impaired, and we're all going to be on a spectrum of executive function. Kind of where do we stand? It's really only a problem if it's a problem. What I've often found is, you know, if we're going through even treating patients, people like, am I going to be on these medications the entire time? I look at medications as just the initial stepping stone. So we can get that initial bit of executive function at our baseline, at our most boring times. And then can we start building those other habits and routines, the structure, the, you know, using to-do lists, planners, organizers, getting that structure to life, which so many people, it seems so simple. But for people with ADHD, it's like it goes in one ear out the other. Everyone tells them, you know, just use this planner, use this strategy. It just doesn't stick. What I start to find is medications aren't the end all be all, but it's sometimes it's that crucial stepping stone so you can start getting those other things to stick. Or even now in therapy and coaching and being able to use the tools that you're learning, get them to stick. And what I actually start to find is, you know, as time goes on with patients, you know, it takes some time to get to the, kind of that stable place, get this into the kind of the new norm. But what I start to find is basically people's prescriptions start to last. They have to basically reach out to get them refilled. You can't have refills. And what I start to find is the time between prescriptions, as they're able to take some more time off, they're able to rely on the structure and the scaffolding that they've built, is they start building those habits and routines. And that's what's going to take them to the next level.
Talking with Dr. Jake Behrens, who is a Milwaukee psychiatrist specializing in the evaluation and treatment of adult ADHD. As you talk about planners and organizers and accommodations, let's bring in Sam in Madison with a question. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Hi. One thing that I haven't heard much about over the last 10 years since I've been diagnosed is accommodations in the workplace. Had a lot of success, I think, in my career, but it didn't take much as far as, you know, life change with everybody working from home and having children to really throw my routine off. And I really found myself struggling and eventually got terminated from my job for performance issues. And I feel like accommodations maybe would have been something that would have helped me at that point. It's something I would like to hear discussed with.
Sam, thank you for that. Dr. Behrens, what about the workplace and accommodations?
Well, I'm thinking there of, with all of the changes that you know, so many people were thrown into very abruptly here with the pandemic and going to home. I always equate this kind of like when you're growing up in kind of with school, when you're with parents, we start with, you know, from early childhood, we have all the structure, routine, things laid out for us, kind of external executive function done for us. From elementary school, we have one teacher, one class. Parents are telling you what to do, what to wear, when to do it, what to eat. And so to me, it's kind of the rule, not the exception, that when we move on from school, say we move out of the home, we go to college, we start that first job, we're out of the home, we give up all that scaffolding. And that's when we really kind of hit the fan. That's when we're really relying and seeing what is our own executive function like when we take away the other, kind of take the training wheels off, so to speak. That's the same thing I think often with work is there can be so many things that were in place while you were there, the structure, the routine, all these other things, which in a way are kind of treatment. You get thrown into this, into the home environment, no preparation time, trying to adjust to a whole different way of being, different distractions, not having the same routines and structure. And then that's when a lot of the things can hit. Now, I think from an accommodation standpoint, are there things that, you know, some people do very well in quiet environments. Some people actually need some sound, some stimulation in order to get in there. It can be different for different people. I think of starting to learn more, okay, what are potential things that can be helpful on the workplace? Check-ins with supervisors, laid out kind of structure, anything to help with kind of the structure and routine can be helpful. But I think a lot of it can go a long way, but it's an area that we have to start to learn a lot more about, especially when it's trying to adapt to people working from home, which quite frankly is sadly a relatively new phenomenon, because for so long, so many elements of the workforce were fighting to not allow people to work from home. And now they're, you know, took the pandemic for them to finally realize, hey, this is actually a viable way to work. But now we have to learn what are the best ways to support our employees and what kind of accommodations would actually be most helpful for them.
We haven't talked about talk therapy, about cognitive behavioral therapy as a way to manage symptoms. What do you see there? What outcomes might be there?
Mm-hmm. Whenever I'm kind of breaking down, I apologize, I'm talking with my hands a lot. I work a lot with drawing, and I'm always doing whiteboarding with patients when meeting, so I can draw it out. But I always want to break things down into, you know, prescription options, therapy, coaching, exercise, the kind of other non-med kind of things, meditation, you know, checking labs, other testing, getting into more kind of natural supplement side of things. And I always say in there is when we're looking at those, I want to give the full menu of options. Here's some things that are out there. The therapy aspect can, I would say, can be a strong component of just about anything. Having that person to connect with, and especially sometimes I think of going, the coaching aspect might be a bit more kind of structured setting. And I always say it's kind of more like a drill sergeant boot camp kind of thing where you set up, what are you going to do that week? When are you going to do it? And that person can be holding you accountable and really working on kind of tangible goals and skill sets, kind of that external accountability. Mm-hmm. All of those things can go hand in hand with medication, non-medication. And something, you know, in our field, say if we're looking at anxiety or depression, I can't tell you that an antidepressant, like a medication, is going to have a higher likelihood of benefit for, you know, moderate type of things compared to therapy, compared to exercise, compared to some supplement regimens. ADHD is one of few areas where the medications actually stand out as having a higher effect size, kind of higher likelihood of having some benefit in there. And I don't see, it's not the end all be all. But sometimes I think of doing things in kind of a stepped approach, see where things play out, see what are we getting help with, and then use a lot of those other things to kind of fill in the gaps or kind of fine tune around the edges as we need to. But I'd say any way you look at it, if you're pairing kind of therapy and coaching with the medication side of it, we generally see kind of faster, kind of more complete outcomes.
Psychiatrist Jake Behrens with us, helping us understand adult ADHD. Still time to share your story, managing symptoms, daily life, treatment options, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Behrens here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about adult ADHD with psychiatrist Jake Behrens here this hour. Has a clinic focusing on seeing patients that involves problems with inability to pay attention, hyperactivity, impulse behavior. Dr. Behrens with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Grace now in Lake Geneva. Grace, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have an adult son, so this is not my story, but when he was an older teen, diagnosed with OCD and ADHD, and his doctor explained to us that what's going on in the brain for both of those disorders are sort of in conflict with one another. And so medicating both of them can be tricky. Hmm. And so I'm curious, my son eventually just got fed up with taking medication every day and weaned himself off. But I can really tell that, you know, his symptoms for ADHD are interfering. He's 20 now. So I'm just curious if this new medication that I think you guys are going to talk mm-hmm. a little more about would alleviate that conflict, or if he even agrees with that conflict, that what's happening in the brain with those two disorders yes. is hard to treat.
Grace, thank you. Obsessive compulsive disorder at the intersection of ADHD. Dr. Behrens.
In here, with ADHD, it's probably more the rule, not the exception, that it likely can be other kind of like comorbid conditions that might be diagnosed with it. Are they related to untreated ADHD? Is it something separate can be different? With any of these conditions, you know, we want to find, okay, what, to me, regardless of what we call something, is what we're doing to treat it beneficial for the patient? Is the patient functioning? I look more at function than I do nomenclature. But when it comes to treating, can I say that they're like, are they opposed? I'd say it's far more complicated than simply saying one's going to oppose the other. We're working in different systems, even as we know from the neurobiology of what's going on. We're kind of looking at different pathways, different areas of the brain. So I can't say that they're opposing one another in terms of what are they activating, what are they stimulating, which areas are they promoting. But I think looking to treat them both kind of simultaneously, even my own experience is actually working to treat them simultaneously can often be effective, especially from the OCD, if you're bringing in truly kind of a very strong cognitive behavioral therapy approach along with it. I wouldn't look at it as being a rule out, like an absolute contraindication in that way, but certainly something you want to follow. With the new medication.
I was going to say Qelbree. Yes, go ahead.
With Qelbree here, well, technically it's now the second non-stimulant medication approved for ADHD in adults. It's been out for about a year in kids where they had the approval, and then they just got the FDA approval in the past, I don't know, 2 weeks or so for adults. It actually been used as an antidepressant in Europe for a lot longer. It was being taken 3 times a day, so people weren't able to do that. Now it's an extended release form. If there's concerns with the use of stimulants, concerns for substance abuse, eating disorders, heart concerns, conditions, or if they have major concerns in here in terms of what, you know, is it something going to be too stimulating? It's a reasonable option. Qelbree, you know, we always have generic names on there. It's the data that's been out there has been showing instead of, you know, the general kind of like 4 to 6 weeks to see potential changes, and it's potentially more in like kind of that 2 week time for adults, still something where you have to titrate dosing, side effect profile. Just because it's a non-stimulant doesn't mean it doesn't have side effects, but it's a reasonable thing to look at. I think the biggest thing that would be in there is, quite frankly, is cost. We always talk about new medications, but in my opinion, whenever I'm talking with patients, I always want to bring up, what is this going to cost? It could be different for every individual based on insurance. I can't say any of these things are necessarily worth spending a large sum of money for if you don't need to. This is just me, but I generally tell my patients in the field here of ADHD, we have a lot of very evidence-based medications. If we were starting on something, my general rule, I talk about prices with my patients all the time. I think it should be part of healthcare. I generally say it's not worth spending more than $30 when you're first starting.
Grace, thank you for that call. Sam in Eau Claire. Sam, hi. You also wanted to bring up cost barriers.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I was diagnosed, and I took it for a while. I was diagnosed through a psychologist, I believe, and I stopped taking it at some point. I went to college a little later in life, and I wanted to start taking it again because I was really struggling. And I didn't really have the funds to go through extensive retesting, and my prior medical records were lost. I spoke to my primary care provider about it, and at that time, they started me on, you know, some like methylphenidate or something along those lines. And at some point, I had to change primary care providers, and what I found was those doctors started to be really skeptical of that, and they were really you know, I had one that like straight up accused me of like drug seeking. And it's interesting having been on ADHD meds for like at least 10 years now. And my wife will even notice if I go a day without. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on sort of that skepticism and stigma around it. And then I guess as a closing, if there's time, I'm curious if there's any correlation between ADHD and emotional regulation.
Sam, thanks.
Fortunately, it's the landscape that we're in where, you know, we think all doctors or, you know, healthcare providers are, that we all have exactly the same standards that we're following. That's not the case. We're all individuals. We all have our own biases, the things that we look at. It's going to be ADHD, from what I've seen, is a very, within the profession, is a very stigmatized type of condition in here. Different providers will have different stances on it. You know, aligning with someone that understands where it's coming from. I'm not saying everyone has ADHD, not saying that we can't have skepticism with it, but we'll see more of that with certain people. And I think that that's a kind of a tragedy. And that comes down to even the education that we as physicians kind of go through. But I'm with you, the amount that what I see patients go through, like I follow, this is kind of even following in different Facebook communities between psychiatrists and the general population with an ADHD, and I almost see on like minute for minute basis where they line up, where it's like physicians complaining about people wanting to look at ADHD. And then the patient side of it is people like, oh my gosh, like how frustrating it is for them trying to go through this procedure. And there's that big discord between the two sides. Granted, you know, there's such a thing as overdiagnosis. There's certainly underdiagnosis. We have to look at what is it like to undertreat the population. That's what I think is not really looked at enough. What are we missing? What are the struggles that we're putting people through, especially kind of artificially, you know, if we have that given history? I think the fact that quote unquote medical records were lost, you know, people want to get records from childhood. I would have no idea how to get my records. I think that's a bigger problem in healthcare where we don't empower the patients to have their own story, their own record. It's this, I'm trying to fax, because the only way we do it, I'm trying to fax to a primary care right now as we speak. Faxes don't go through. I can't get this over. The only way that they'll accept anything is via fax. What I found is I want to be able to provide all the records directly to my patients so you can share them with whomever. And it's your story. It's your information. Hopefully make it easier. When it comes to the emotional regulation, there is so much in there. I just think of the impulsivity. If we just think of ADHD, I don't like the term, it's way too simplistic. But we think of what's going on with executive function. We talk about the impulsivity aspect to it. Are we able to slow down? Are we able to regulate what else is going in the mind? So you can imagine that can really affect what's going on with the emotional side of it. It's been described more as rejection sensitive dysphoria. I often look at it often paired with ADHD, so I call it a formal diagnosis, but I look at that as a lot more of like reactionary, irritable, short fuse type of moods.
Dr. Behrens, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jake Behrens, psychiatrist, evaluates and treats patients with ADHD clinic in Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.